What's going on, historians from around the internet? Welcome back to the Old History Podcast, part of the Old History Project, where, as I'll say another thousand times, the goal here is to just talk about history so that maybe somebody somewhere might learn something. So, last weekend, I did a cool thing. I went out to Circle Park here in Granger County and took a video. Well, we went out there because we thought there was an old cemetery in the very, very back of the property. Turns out there is, but all of the graves are gone. Well, all of the grave markers are gone. The people are still in the clay, but I guess the stones must have fell over, or maybe TVA knocked them over, I don't know. Anyway, went out there, shot a video for the YouTube channel. Took a really cool video of the old highway and the railroad that used to run through there. So, it was really neat. You know, a lot of people didn't know that. And a couple of people messaged me privately and like, "Hey man, do you know there's a cave out there?" I'm like, "Well, I almost fell into one when I was little, walking out through there. I can't remember where it was." And well, they told me where it was. So, provided that it stops snowing, I'm going to go try and find it. And because some of the caves around here have never been studied under an archaeological setting, and I know at least in the Indian cave, they found Paleo-Indian stuff, you know, Bronze Age stuff from like 5,000 years ago in that cave, and that's significant. But there hasn't been any digs in that cave since like the 80s, so. Going back out there, and then also I'm going to go take a quick video of the old Three Springs Hotel Foundation. I got permission to go out there. The guy's super nice, and apparently he grew up with my dad, so I mean it only helped. But for those of you that like to explore, I cannot stress to you enough, going out in the cold, take a buddy, tell somebody where you're going, you know, prepare for the occasion, because you don't actually know what you're going to run into wherever you're going. Some places here are just really, really far back there. And if something were to happen, you know, authorities would be 20, 30 minutes away. And, you know, every minute counts in certain situations. So always take a buddy, tell somebody where you're going, and always ask for permission. So, let's take a quick break here, and we'll get into this week's podcast. Alright, so I know I said I was going out to these places tomorrow, but it'll actually be either Saturday or Sunday, because I record these podcasts the day before, and then I have them set up to release at 5 o'clock in the morning, because I know some people are... Well, they like to wake up really, really early. All right, so we had already wrapped up the Revolution, and we just took a quick break to cover the War of 1812 and the Louisiana Purchase. So the next thing to talk about, we're going to start going over the politics. I wanted to take a break from the Revolution and just get a little bit ahead of myself here, you know, maybe cover something else for somebody. So the articles, the next thing to talk about would be, sorry, it's my dog, would be to talk about the Articles of Confederation and, you know, the state constitutions and stuff like that. So we'll start this out with the state constitutions, and then we'll roll into the Articles of Confederation. And these are very important things to talk about, especially if you're into politics, because then understanding, you know, the Articles of Confederation and why the Constitution and stuff like that was written, the really key things for people with a political know-how to understand, because the basis of everything will almost always come back to these three things in American history. So, all right, so the state constitutions. So the war was over. The United States is very poor, and the government is basically held together by hopes and dreams. So the states were now facing some pretty serious and very complex questions about how to make rules. And well, they didn't really know anything outside of royal authority with, on stuff like that. In a monarchy, it's basically popular rule, popular sovereignty, which was that the people, people were the highest authority. So what we want to do? What were we going to do about that? So we didn't really want to be a monarchy. And I probably misquoted that a little bit. So royal authority was based on popular rule. So, and popular sovereignty was the idea that the people were the highest authority. All right, cleared that up. So just about every state answered these differently. Every colony, well, it would have been states at that time, but most cases, colonial traditions were continued, but they were modified a little bit, so that the governor, who was the executive, lost all significant power, while the legislative branch, aka the assemblies back then, which represented the people most directly, became a whole lot more important. So, Pennsylvania created the most radical state constitution of the period, and they followed the idea of popular rule to some sort of logical conclusion. They created a state government with several distinct features. And first would be the Pennsylvania Constitution of 1776, which abolished property requirements for voting as well as for holding office. If you were an adult man who paid taxes, then you are allowed to vote or even run for an office. This was a dramatic expansion of who was considered a political person. But other aspects of the new state government were even more radical. Pennsylvania also became a unicameral government, I guess I pronounced that right, where legislature only had one body and the office of the governor was entirely eliminated. Radicals in Pennsylvania observed that the governor was really just like a small-scale king, and that an upper legislative body, like the House of Lords in English Parliament, were supposed to represent wealthy men and aristocrats rather than continue those forms of government. Pennsylvania decided that the people could rule most effectively through a single body with complete legislative power. Many conservative patriots met Pennsylvania's new design with horror. John Adams described the Pennsylvania Constitution, and he only had bad things to say about it. To him, it was so democratical that it must produce confusion in every evil work, quote unquote. Clearly, popular rule didn't mean sweeping democratic changes to all the patriots. And then we'll get into South Carolina here. There were three key states that had developed very, very different constitutions. South Carolina's constitution in 1778 created new rules that were on the opposite end of the political spectrum from Pennsylvania. In South Carolina, white men had to possess a significant amount of property to vote, and they had to own even more property to be allowed to run for a political office. And in fact, these property requirements were so high that 90% of all white adults were prevented from running from any political office. So that's kind of weird. So Pennsylvania does away with owning property, but South Carolina takes it to like a whole different extreme. So the limitation of who could be an elected leader reflected a central tradition of 18th century Anglo-American political thought, where only individuals who were financially independent were believed to have the self-control to make responsible and reasonable judgments about all public matters. As a result, poor white men, all women, children, and African Americans, whether free or slave, were considered too dependent on others to exercise reliable political judgment. While most of these traditional exclusions from political participation have had been ended in America today, age limitations remain largely unchallenged. And then the next one to talk about, well, actually, before we talk about the Massachusetts state constitution, we need to make a note that the Virginia Constitution was equally almost as important as all of these combined, because the state of Franklin loosely based their constitution off of the Virginia Constitution. And I believe that the United States Constitution also adopted the Virginia Constitution. Don't quote me on that, but it's still a little too early in the morning here. But those are things to keep in mind. There were all of these, but I think the United States really kind of just drew from all of these together, with it being based on the Virginia Constitution. So in 1780, the creation of the Massachusetts State Constitution offered another way to answer some of these very complicated questions that all of these other states had been taking to one extreme to another extreme. So Massachusetts wanted to answer some of the questions about the role of the people in creating a Republican government when the state legislature presented voters with a proposed constitution in 1778. It was actually rejected because the people thought that this was too important an issue for the government to present to the people. The government could make its own rules, then it could change them whenever it wanted, and easily take away the people's liberties. Following through this logic, Massachusetts held a special convention in 1780, where specially elected representatives met to decide on the best framework for the new state government. This idea of a special convention of the people to decide important constitutional issues was a new way of thinking about popular rule that would play a pretty important role in the ratification of the national constitution. And so we'll just take us a quick break here, and then we'll get into the Articles of Confederation. And so just before we get into that, I want to ask you guys a question, and you can answer this on any post that I make on the Facebook page or on the YouTube channel. Some guy posted a comment on one of my videos that said, and he claims, Tennessee history, anything pre-1796 is not Tennessee history. I want to know what you guys think. Do you think 1796 should be like North Carolina history? Do you think it should be Virginia history? Or do you think it should just be out there on its own as Southwest Territory history? What do you guys think? I want to know, because that's an interesting statement, you know, and that's a perspective I hadn't thought of. But in my own personal view, it is Tennessee history. Because, well, you know what? I'll let you guys decide. But honestly, it's kind of hard to not say that it isn't Tennessee history, because so many important things happened here. Like, the first house here was built in 1762, 10 years before anybody else came down here. You had the Watauga Confederation, you had the Holston Constitution, Transylvania Purchase. All of that led up to make Tennessee what it is today. Those are things to consider when you answer this question for me. In fact, I think you can actually answer here on Anchor. I think you can comment on the podcast. I want to know, so answer that question. All right, so the Articles of Confederation. So While all the individual state constitutions were being created and everybody was trying to figure out just what to do and how they're going to run this new country, the Constitutional Continental Congress would continue to meet as a political body. And despite being now a central government, it was a very loose confederation, and most of the significant power was held by the individual states. So by 1777, members of Congress realized that they should have some sort of very clearly written rules for how they were organized. And as a result, the Articles of Confederation were drafted and passed by Congress in November. The first national constitution of the United States was not really innovative and mostly put into written form how the Congress had operated since 1775. Even though the articles were rather modest in their proposals, they would not be ratified by all states until 1781. Even this was accomplished largely because of the dangers of war and demanded greater cooperation. The purpose of the central government was clearly stated in the articles. Congress had control over diplomacy, printing money, resolving controversies between different states, and most importantly, coordinating the war effort. The most important action of the Continental Congress was probably the creation and maintenance of the Continental Army. Even in this area, the central government's power was quite limited. While Congress could call on states to contribute specific resources and numbers of men for the army, it was not allowed to force states to obey the central government's request for aid. And I'm not going to get into modern politics with that, but I want you guys to consider how this plays into some events that are going on today. Just those are things to think about. And like I said, I'm not going to get into modern politics. I keep old history out of that. But this still plays in a very important part in today's politics and the way things work. And it's so cool to see that. So the organization of Congress itself demonstrates the primacy of state power. Each state had one vote. 9 out of 13 states had to support a law for it to be enacted. And furthermore, any changes to the articles themselves would require unanimous agreement. In the one state, one vote rule, state sovereignty was given a primary place even within the national government. Further, the whole national government consisted entirely of unicameral, one body, Congress, with no executive and no judicial organizations. The National Congress's limited power was especially clear when it came to money issues, and not surprisingly, given that the Revolution's causes had centered on opposition to unfair taxes, the central government had no power to raise its own revenues through taxation. All it could do was request that the states give it the money necessary to run the government and wage the war. And by 1780, with the outcome of the war still very much undecided, the central government had run out of money and was bankrupt. As a result, the paper money it issued became basically worthless. And so we'll talk about Robert Morris here, and he became the Congress Superintendent of Finance in 1781, and he forged a solution to this bankruptcy dilemma. Morris expanded existing government power and secured special privileges to the Bank of North America in an attempt to stabilize the value of the paper money issued by the Congress. His actions went beyond the limited powers granted to the national government by the Articles of Confederation, but he did succeed in limiting runaway inflation and resurrecting the fiscal stability of the national government. And so, with that, we'll end the Articles of Confederation. And we'll get into drafting the Constitution here on the next podcast, and we'll talk about Shays' Rebellion and all that. So just think about how the Articles of Confederation they still reflect a lot of things today, and that's still so amazing. So, all that being said, we'll wrap this podcast up for the day. If you made it this far, you can subscribe to the podcast for 99 cents a month if you like it. Not required. And also keep your eyes on the Facebook, on the YouTube channel, because I will be uploading a video maybe this weekend. So see you guys next weekend. Have a great day and stay safe out there.